Welcome to Data Science Perspectives. This series focuses on analytics and data science professionals from across industry to learn about how their career unfolded, what skills they look for when hiring, and what trends they think are coming next. I'm your host, Bill Franks. Let's get to it. Welcome to this episode of Data Science Perspectives. I'm your host, Bill Franks. Today, I'm going to be joined by Dwight Speck, Vice President of Digital Transformation and Strategy at Bridgestone American. I first met Dwight probably close to 10 years ago when he was with North Highland Consulting and I was still with Teradata. Since then, we frequently talked and shared notes about both what's been happening in the local analytics area community as well as more general trends. As I mentioned, he's currently a Vice President for Bridgestone's America, which is, as you might guess, the U.S. division of the global tire and automotive juggernaut. Before that, he had spent close to 10 years in a variety of senior roles related to data and analytics consulting at North Highland Consulting. Before North Highland, he was the Chief Operating Officer at software provider and Microsoft partner IBIS, and he had also spent time at a small consulting firm called ePartners for a total of about 10 years. Dwight has a bachelor's in accounting and MIS from Florida Atlantic University. And with that, let's welcome Dwight to the show. Well, thanks for joining me on the show today, Dwight.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for having me.
So the question I always like to start everybody out with is to understand their own personal journey to get into this world of analytics and data science. And so in your case, what got you into it early in your career?
Oh, that's a great question. So I guess short answer is I did a startup in the early stage data engineering space. And then that led me into back-end engineering that eventually led into a career in BI and then eventually analytics. Longer story is that I went to school specifically to get a degree in accounting and MIS, the idea being that I wanted to be involved with large-scale systems because at the time, the majority of the IT world was being spent like manufacturing inventory systems and all of that. So I figured I would be a programmer and eventually systems analyst in that. Then a few years after I graduated school and did that, I actually started up a company focused on Microsoft SQL Server. That was right after they bought it from Sybase. So I got very involved with SQL Server when it was a nascent technology and we were scaling the client server curve. And then in the course of doing that, I did a absolutely massive system rollout for a company where we had written, well over 2,500 custom reports. And in the after action report for the project, we kind of looked at like how we could have done that better. And we realized we actually wrote about 12 or 15 reports with about a ton of variations. And that's when we started exploring what at the time was kind of nascent data warehousing and analytical Microsoft analysis services tool, well, lab tools, right? And then that led me into a multi-year trend towards BI and building out BI systems. And then when statistics and math became more involved in that in terms of getting involved in data science, then that's when I started building team capabilities around that. So I've always been in the data space, but it was that progression that led me into analytics.
That's cool. You definitely got into things on the early end of that too. I know.
Yeah. Did I just date myself in those comments?
No, but it's great because, you know, especially younger folks, everyone takes for granted these, you know, these point and click reporting tools and how easy it is just to write queries and so forth. And, you know, within the span of your and my career, it wasn't a trivial thing to do at all. And so when those tools came out and started to get out there, it really changed things a lot for big business.
Yeah, I mean, we used to have to walk uphill in the data stack both ways, right, on our knees when someone was whipping us. So, yeah. No, and it's kind of interesting, though, because on the one hand, some of the things that used to be really hard for us are massively easy now. But what I find fascinating is that every new technology engenders some form of massive complexity that gives you career opportunity. Ours was knowing the full stack end to end because you had no choice to. Now that full stack end to end knowledge is nowhere near as important because you can spin up a system in AWS or Azure, or you can just put workload into, I forget what Microsoft's calling Azure Data Lake now, but in that model, right? But then you start looking at the complexity of what the high-end engineers are doing in generative AI and LLM, and I'm like, wow, that is super difficult stuff. Everybody bit as difficult as the stuff we did earlier in our career. So there's always that thing where you've got to know way more about it and be way deeper than anybody else.
Yeah. Well, and I think followed from that is why there's been a career path for people for many years, because whatever that next thing is, when it first hits, nobody knows it. And so everybody's scrambling to learn it. And those people who are able to go learn it first and then get good at it have, you know, career security for another 4 or 5, at most 10 years before the next thing hits. And so I think being a little bit of a chameleon has been key for folks of our generation.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
So I know out of school, you initially went into what was at the time, a small regional consulting firm. And over time, it ended up getting acquired and integrated into some larger companies. But what led you to go into consulting early in your career? Because obviously not everybody chooses that path.
Yeah, my first few years, and not very many of them, were working for financial institutions. And I really found... I've discovered one thing, and I had a bit of a macroeconomic issue. So the one thing I found was I was just bored at the pace of change. There was a lot of interesting stuff going on in technology which banks were working on at the time. The second one is I had come out of college when the American banking industry was going through one of its periodic crises. This is back the real estate, when savings and loans were all failing. And there just wasn't a great history working for banks at that point. I literally worked for the same institution, for three institutions without ever moving my desk, because one failed and got taken over, then the feds took over that and so on. Wow. So that's when I decided, you know what, I want to be a little bit more embedded in technology, and I got an opportunity to work for a very small consulting firm, which I ended up buying and then growing and then selling it off. And that was the startup I told you about in the client server space with Microsoft SQL Server. So that's how I got into it. And I just found the minute I hit consulting, I just loved it, because you were solving problems that were beneficially impacting people's lives. You got to help them define the problem. You got to define the solution. You were the expert. You had to be better educated and more knowledgeable than anybody. So for someone that's got the desire to build, which I do, it was a great technology career for me. And I think if I hadn't done that, because my desire to build, I probably would have ended up as like a plumber or an electrician, because I like to leave things behind.
Well, I know you spent some time, you were the chief operating officer for IBIS, which was a consulting and software firm that did a lot of work with Microsoft. Then I know you obviously spent many years at North Highland in a variety of senior roles. So even within that consulting context, obviously a software focused company versus more of a services focused company, things evolved over the years. Like how did you see the consulting practices that you were involved in change over those years?
Yeah. Wow. I guess here we have to be a little bit wonky about our segmentation of the consulting industry, Bill, because as you know, there are consultancies that, and I'm going to be very broad brushed, and this isn't wildly accurate, right? There are consultancies whose entire thing is around selling and implementing a product. So you can think about folks whose entire specialty is standing up and running SAP for people, right? So their consulting workforce is knowledgeable and engaged in a tool set. And then there are consultancies, and let's just call those, to differentiate them from product-based consultancies, management consultancies, whose job is to advise companies on how to do things better, right? So they usually don't have a product-based tool they're implementing. They instead are working their professional advice. Well, what I've seen, the product-based consultancies, kind of their, the big change we saw there is that their business model shoved more and more over to services because they couldn't depend on a revenue stream coming off product sales any longer because everything moved to the cloud, right? So they had to be far more innovative in what they offered the customers, and they had to cover in, you know, kind of a deeper stack of things that were all part of that big monolithic cloud-based stack the provider provided. They also got enormous pricing pressure because a lot of those kind of bread and butter implementation roles got moved offshore over time. So that was a big change there. The big change that I've seen in the and by the way, these differentiators aren't clear because if you look at a company like Accenture, they do a ton of management consulting, but they also do a ton of system implementation. So it's not pure by company, but inside the business, inside the company, there's separate units. For management consultancy, though, the big thing that's changed is so much of their revenue stream came off large-scale program and change management work. Kind of cheap, like we're going to put someone in place for the CIO as their chief of staff. They're going to run major programs and projects. And a lot of that revenue evaporated back in the kind of 2008 to 2012 era. We went through a major recession. There was enough of those complex skill sets available in the market where companies figured out that they can insource those or push them offshore or whatever was appropriate. So we began to see a focus on higher value services, and a lot of the higher value services other than strategy work, the companies just were forced into being very, very skilled in the technology space. And a lot of that was in the data space. The data was a fact of life. It was driving massive change for people. It was an underused corporate asset. And in a lot of cases, a badly used corporate asset. And the companies that really dove into how do you get your data to be a valuable asset so you can use it, monetize it, drive more productive operations, drive better connection to the customer, better understand your customer. Those are the consultancies that ended up, you know, doing really well. And all that's kind of headlined under digital. That's kind of the buzzword. Like, are you really truly digital? Can you do things in agile fashion? Do you have access to your data? Can you make business sense of your data? Can you do something value with it to allow you to better understand customer behavior? And then in the course of doing that, that of course drove a lot of the data science work that we've been seeing. So that's been the big change over time, is just more and more focus on, you have to create these kinds of tangible returns with data and digital technologies. Boy, I feel like I just kind of went off on that for a while.
It does. And so let's dig in one layer deeper on that, you know, especially throughout your time at North Highland, where you were focused heavily on the data and analytics. So even within that general shift you mentioned, what were some of the things you saw changing in terms of what clients were looking for from a consultancy as it specifically related to data and analytics projects? Was it, you know, was it more that they, you know, they wanted to manage it but get some augmented resources? Did they still want you guys to be handling the strategy? Like, kind of how did the client side demand evolve?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm gonna make the, maybe what I'll do is I'll say there's three major categories of client demand here, right? And they generally are, we don't really know how to make best use of our data. They need someone to come in and say, okay, you know, for your business strategy, how do you improve it through a higher quality data asset? So that's kind of early stage. We don't know what to do, but we know we need to do something. And that's where data strategy work occurs. There was a lot of that much earlier in this cycle. So call that, you know, now you're going back 10 or 15 years. There's a lot more of that discussion on how do we get better at data, right? And then the next stage after that is, okay, creating some kind of data asset. Really, we're talking about data management or data engineering here. Create a data warehouse, data lake, whatever time segment we're talking about, term used. In other words, a central data location for the data so we can make business sense out of it and people can get to it. And then, and that's more of an implementation issue. So they'll come to consultancies, you know, the demand for consultancies then was building those assets. But the ongoing, the as those technologies matured, the ongoing like implementation, build, and support pushed more and more towards the large scale offshore firms like TCS, Tata Consulting Services, or Wipro, or any of the big offshore enablers that do implementation work. And then the next tranche was folks that are like, well, we've got a bunch of data, but it's kind of meaningless because we don't do a good job at controlling it or governing it. We can't be confident that the data we're seeing that has a customer number on it is truly representative of Bill Franks as a customer. Can we see the entire universe of work he did? So that's the next major layer. We've got our data assets in, but is the data clean? Is it usable? Is it useful? And then the last one is, okay, now that we've got all of that, can we be more advanced and thoughtful in our thinking? And that's where, you know, the analytics space comes in. So the depending on what kind of consulting firm you are, there's opportunities at each one. With North Highland, we played a lot more in the data strategy and get them started in the engineering space than did a fair amount of work in the analytics back end, but we generally didn't operationalize it. Every company is going to be in a different stage. Every division of the company is going to be in a different stage, and those stages tend to morph over time. So even at Bridgestone, we've got elements of the company that are amazingly advanced in what they're doing with data, like our fleet management systems. And I put them up against any other company in the world in terms of the insight they can generate for the customer. And there's other sections of the company where they're just getting the journey started and they're defining their data strategy. So one company does not necessarily occupy one space all the time. It can be variation. Again, I said a lot of words there. So did that really get to the answer of the question you're looking?
I think so. And, you know, you mentioned in both the last two answers a pretty broad spectrum of types of work and so forth. And yet you were able to, you know, have a role in all of that. So what are one or two of the skills or traits you have that you think most help you navigate as all those changes occurred and be able to, you know, continue to be in a strong leadership role throughout those changeovers?
Well, let's first debate the term strong leadership role. I'm not going to own that space. If you want to go get independent reviews whether I'm a worthwhile leader, I'd encourage you to talk to people that work with me. But I don't want to be the guy that stands up here and like mounts the leadership pedestal and claims that space. I kind of feel like that's getting up and saying, yeah, I'm a strong leader in the space is a little bit like being out with someone and going, I'm funny, really. I've got a great sense of humor. You know, if you have to claim the space rather than showing it.
How about I ask you a different way? How did you manage to not lose your job for those years?
Yeah, how to stay
relevant.
What
skills or traits helped you not get fired? How about that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, you know, personally, I'm avidly curious and I've been a lifelong reader. So I probably do at least 20 or 25 hours of reading a week to stay current in my industry. Some weeks, not so much, some weeks more than that. But I do a lot of reading. So you've just got to, in an industry as rapidly changing as anything in technology, but specifically analytics, you've got to get really good at consuming information. Now, I will say when I was earlier in my career, I did way more of it. And under way more pressure because of course you're learning a vast amount. And then as you go along in your, well, the best thing I can do is give you an example as a programming language, right? The very first language I learned, I had to invest a lot of time to become a decent engineer. But then the next time I had to learn something, it was easier because the fundamental underlying structures of how do you do something recursively or how do you issue an execution or how do you write a web service, right? You just need to know how to do it there. So, you know, I was already pretty good at SQL when I decided to take on Python, and I had, you know, past history in other programming languages like C# and VB.NET. So when I went to learn Python, it was a pretty easy lift because all I had to do was go look for the programmatic structures I needed and know how to use them in the rules in Python. So, but I think so that's like a personal journey is you've got to continue learning. But what most people, you know, if you want to take the perspective in giving advice or guidance to someone that's maybe navigating their way through their career. you can't be in any of the technology disciplines. You start out building a craft skill set. In other words, you have to become a master craftsperson and very deep in a thing. So if you graduate with a degree in data science, you're going to be spending your next 3 to 10 years ideally becoming the best data scientist you possibly can be, which is going to be about individual craft skills, individual contribution. As you grow in your career, though, if you have the desire to broaden your impact, then you have no choice but to think about, how do I lead others? How do I lead small teams, larger teams, and enterprises? And there, the craft skill becomes less and less about, am I the best data scientist? And becomes more and more about, am I the best person to help the data scientists that work for me be themselves the best data scientists? Am I clearing obstacles for them? Am I giving clear direction? Am I setting objectives properly? Am I not micromanaging? Am I empowering teams below me? So that's that kind of thinking, that very, that I'd call it almost product-based thinking. Like, what's the major, like, what is it I really need to do here to empower the job getting done? That allows you to be relevant across a lot more disciplines. Now, in every one of the disciplines I've been involved in, I've gotten deep enough to really understand the functional basics of it. Not necessarily deep enough to be an executor there, but enough to understand what the people that I was responsible to needed for me in order to be. So that was really the way I went about being relevant across all of those. So just to recap, it was kind of incremental knowledge lifts, but it was more about understanding what the customer we served needed and then what the team needed from me in order to make sure they could do the best work for the customer. I hadn't really thought that through before, but I guess that's probably about the way I'd look at it. Does that make sense?
No, that does make sense. And, you know, you recently, for the first time, went client side, you know, your role now at Bridgestone. And so I'm just curious, now that you're, you know, after many years of not being on the client side, you're on the client side, I'm sure you've noticed some things that, you know, you feel like you're able to bring because you have that other experience. And there might be some areas you realize, wow, you know, this is something I've got to learn more about. So how's that transition been to that new environment?
Yeah, it's been interesting. You know, when consultants come in, they have a scope of services that they've negotiated or has been negotiated and has been handed to them. So they're very narrowly tasked, right? I think maybe some would argue that they're not really narrowly tasked, because like McKinsey, Bain, BCG, they'll walk in and do corporate strategy, but even then their goal is to produce a strategy document for the board, right? The portfolio of concern is a lot broader for me going in client side. Now, I don't want to speak generally to everybody, but, you know, inside North Highland, inside IBIS, inside ePartners, I was part of operating the firm. And facing the client, I was part of a project team to accomplish this very specific goal. What I'm realizing now is I'm going into a company where I both have some of the aspects of a consulting responsibility in that I am tasked with, you know, do this work as head of strategy for the product factory. But I also have to be very concerned about how the business is running. So it's kind of both. A lot of consulting skills are being brought in. At the same time, I have to think about running the firm. So it's a really fascinating change. And it is interesting. So that's point one. Point two, it's really interesting to be on the inside of a major corporation going through budgeting cycles. We always saw it from the outside and how it affected us in selling contracts. Now we're I'm on the inside seeing how the sausage is made. So that's been fascinating and explains a lot of things I didn't understand being in the consulting side in terms of how we had to get contracts done with clients. I now get a lot of the detail behind it, which is kind of cool. And then the last one, spending so many years in consulting, I just assumed that all the smart people were in consulting. So I've been disabused of that notion pretty quick. I work with some really interestingly brilliant individuals, who really do great and deep thinking, and do phenomenal work that you never hear about because it's done inside the firewall. In particular, there's a guy named Lorenzo Oliva and I might have pronounced his last name wrong, that runs our R&D lab, who's just a brilliant data scientist. He's got a team of brilliant data scientists working for him, where they're trying to build a combination of hardware and software systems that can, detect tire tread depth without having like mesh embedded in the tire manufacturing. How do you determine the tread depth of a tire, right? Can you do it visually with cameras? Can you do it with a drive over sensor? Is there some other way to do it? And it's a surprisingly difficult problem if you just think about the kind of stuff that a tire drives through every day. Like, how do you measure tread depth? And then there's a guy named Jason Beyer that runs data and analytics for all of Bridgestone Americas. And they've just released this amazing data product called Developer Garage, API-driven access to almost our entire data landscape. It's fascinating stuff. So I'm learning a ton there.
I think it's a really interesting point you made that I don't think I've ever heard anyone make the same way, which is I tend to agree with you from my years of consulting. There are definitely people in consulting who assume that they're not just that they're the smartest in the room, but that all the smart people are in the consulting. I will say I never fully bought into that, but at the same time, I think it is true that though people in consulting tend to have more visibility for what they're doing, so you might be more aware of it versus the people within a company. They're often under, various NDAs. They're not going out publicly as much. It's not part of the thing. And so they're more quietly achieving great things rather than the consultancies who both the individuals and the company itself will tout those great things and make it more visible.
Yeah, I will say that just flipping that around a bit, one of the strengths of a great consultant and consultancy, if you've worked at a company for 15, 18 years, you tend to become, unless you are really disciplined about going outside the company boundary, going to conferences, talking to other people, doing research, you tend to get invested in whatever the company is doing, right? You tend not to hear about new things. You tend not to get pushed aggressively to the edge. Now, I would exempt maybe AWS, Microsoft, Google from this kind of thing. I'm talking more traditional companies. With the strength of the consultancy is that you get challenged by so many different environments that you do tend to be able to bring in new ideas. And that is one thing that we do look at our consulting partners to do for us, is to bring in outside ideas. So that's the one thing that you've got to be careful of in the client environment, is making sure that continuing that learning journey outside of the things you're already doing.
So we're almost out of time here. Let's finish with just a real quick one. If you had to pick one thing that you think is going to be one of the biggest impacts in the next 3 to 5 years in the world of data science and analytics, what would you pick that to be sitting here now?
Yeah, I mean, given all the recent news, Bill, it's kind of hard not to land on the large language model and generative AI systems. Yeah. And I think there's two aspects to this. One is we haven't really even scratched the surface of their ability to improve lower cost product, or what's the right way to phrase this? I don't think we're at a space yet where we need to can be concerned about them wholesale replacing jobs. But you can take a marketing content producer, someone that produces content for like a website or whatever, and you can get like 10x production out of them as an individual using a large language model as an assist like ChatGPT, because it's like having a staff of writers working for you, right? So we haven't even really scratched the surface of this yet, and I think it's going to continue to improve rapidly. At the same time, the major regulatory bodies in the state of California, in the U.S. government, particularly in Europe, are responding much faster to the pace of change there than they have in any other piece of technology. So it'll be interesting to see where the regulations start hitting around training data, ownership of IP, particularly human IP, human appearance and human voice. And I think it's watching those two trends hand in hand will be the most impactful thing we'll have seen in the next 3 to 5 years.
Well, I want to thank you so much for taking your time and sharing your thoughts, Dwight. It's always great talking to you, and I appreciate you coming on today.
Well, thanks for having me, Bill. And it's always great talking to you, too. Appreciate it.